Right, this is Jonathan Bernstein conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Paul Garrity on 3rd of May, 2002. It is approximately 10:10 in the morning, Central Standard Time. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, and Mr. Garrity, where exactly are you?
In Carrollton, Texas.
Okay. Now, Mr. Garrity, can you start off, I guess, by giving us a brief biographical sketch of yourself from birth leading up to the time you decided to enter the military?
Okay, I was born November 11th, 1946 in Homestead, Pennsylvania. I grew up my whole life in that area. I went to grade school, a Catholic grade school, went to a public high school. Upon graduating from high school, I worked in the steel mill back in Pittsburgh. And at that time, I became interested in aviation, and I wanted to become an airline pilot. So I was taking flying lessons on my own, and then you needed a college degree to get into the Air Force and then become an airline pilot. That's what I wanted to do.
Mm.
And so I quit the working in the steel mill and went to a junior college called Point Park College in Pittsburgh. I was in my early second semester, my first year, and I got my draft notice.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, everybody was up for the draft.
Okay.
So I told them that I was in college, and they said, well, you had a job deferment when you worked in the steel mill, because I was in an apprenticeship program,
mm-hmm.
and that was a job deferment. And then when I went to college, that was a school deferment. And they said, well, you can't have two different deferments.
Mm.
They said that they would let me finish my second semester, since I was already into the second semester, and then at that time I would be drafted. So without a college degree, I could not go into the Air Force, so the only opportunity I had was to go into the Army and fly helicopters.
Mm-hmm.
So upon my getting out of the second semester, I enlisted into the Army, becoming a helicopter pilot.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what year was this?
That was 1968.
68, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I guess, going into enlist, were you familiar with the warrant officer program, et cetera?
Just what my recruiter told me.
Okay. What exactly? Do you remember what exactly he told you?
In fact, I knew more than what he did about it because I was researching it.
All right.
And I knew that you needed a high school certificate,
mm-hmm.
and you needed to pass their mental test that they gave you.
Okay.
There was some kind of easy test on airplane instruments and so forth,
mm-hmm.
and then your standard military test that you had to take. And you had to meet some minimum requirement scores to qualify for the program.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent. excuse me. Yeah. Let's see. Okay. Moving on to training. Of course, your induction. First impressions of training. What was that like? Basic, et cetera.
You mean after basic training or?
Going into basic training.
In the basic training?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was an eye-opener. The basic training was done in Fort Polk, Louisiana.
Okay.
And that was in the summer of 68.
Okay.
And that's essentially the first time I was down in Louisiana. And being in the summer, it was quite hot and humid.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in a company of, I guess, 50 people. There that they were totally different people. They were from the swamps of Louisiana.
Really?
And everything that you did was based upon demerits.
Mm-hmm.
For some reason, we just didn't get with the program. These guys were lazy. They were not very intelligent. So we were always getting whipped by the DIs and everything, and we always did everything last.
Hmm. Were they all of the guys in your company regular Army, or were they all draftees? Or?
Let's see. I think the majority of them were drafted.
Okay.
There is very little regular Army, and now that you mention it, you had to a lot of times tell your ID number.
Mm-hmm.
And in the ID number, I think it started with RA, which is regular Army.
Right.
And everybody else was drafted or National Guard or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember being criticized all the time because, now what is wrong with you for joining the Army? Why would you ever join the Army?
Mm.
At that time.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Now, because of that, I guess your instructors look on you any differently than the rest, or was there any preferential treatment or anything like that?
One of the instructors, he was back from Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
and he knew that there was a couple of us were in there because of going in to be a helicopter pilot,
mm-hmm.
and he did not like helicopter pilots from his relationship with them in Vietnam.
Really?
Mm-hmm. And so... I didn't think we got any special treatment for being regular Army at all.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, it was, like I said, we were in the minority.
Okay.
And also this guy just didn't like helicopter pilots.
Hmm.
So it was different.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, were there any other instructors that were Vietnam veterans?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Yeah.
Okay. Now, did... I guess at that point, everybody was sort of assuming they were headed to Vietnam. Did your instructors sort of invoke, you know, this is what you're going to need while you're when you're over there, or anything like that to motivate you?
In basic training?
Yeah.
No.
No.
No, it was just your basic training, you know, program.
All right.
Yeah.
Now, then moving on to warrant officer candidate and mm-hmm. and basic flight training. What exactly did that entail? How was that different from basic?
Now you went from Fort Polk, Louisiana, to Fort Walters, Texas here,
yeah.
Here in Mineral Wells.
Right.
And now you were in a group with your peers.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody was geared to fly helicopters at that time.
Okay.
And you were the officers in charge were helicopter pilots that were returned from Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was a very good training. They essentially locked you up for months there at Fort Walters, and everything was programmed. And I thought it was quite well presented.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of discipline. There was a lot of instructions, but of course everybody was there to fly,
mm-hmm.
and that was the enjoyment part of it.
Okay.
So I thought it was a very good, 3 or 4 months there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, any idea what the, what the split was as far as classroom time versus flight time, and what types of aircraft were you flying?
Well, you went to class every day, and you only flew. I think probably 1 hour a day or something like that.
Really?
I really don't remember how many hours you flew a day, but there's a lot of classroom.
Mm-hmm.
And the type of aircraft was those trainers, a TH-55, I think it was,
okay.
A two-seater trainer.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
What'd you think of that aircraft?
It was unstable, that's for sure. It was a small little aircraft. It was very small and is, I don't know, just unique. I mean, after flying airplanes, that was a challenge to fly that thing.
Yeah, actually, I was going to ask, how was the transitioning from fixed wing to rotary wing?
Well, fixed wing is so much easier than rotary wing because, you have so many, especially in that small trainer, because the wind was a major factor in it.
Hmm.
because it was so small and everything, so you had a lot of coordination you had to do all the time with your hands and feet and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Anything? Let's see. I guess anything that was particularly challenging during basic flight training?
In the Fort Walters?
Yeah.
I would imagine getting used to flying a helicopter like that.
Mm.
I think you only had about 10 or 11 hours before you soloed, I believe.
Really?
And maybe it was more than that. I don't remember right now. But anyhow, it was more of the trying to hover that thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 3 feet off the ground and trying to move it left and right and get it into position for takeoff and so forth.
Okay.
That was a real challenge.
Yeah, that seems to be a common theme a lot of guys have said. Okay, now I guess stepping up to Fort Rucker, advanced training, how did the progression go there? Did you transition into H-13s and then... And then to Hueys, or how
no? Well, the instrument part of it was in the H-13,
mm-hmm.
and then the Hueys.
Okay.
The instrument part was very challenging. To fly a helicopter under instrument conditions is very challenging.
Mm.
It's a lot more difficult than flying airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
How so?
Well, I'll give you an example. On my first instrument takeoff, I took off backwards.
Really? Wow.
So, it was a challenge. It was a challenge. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Wow. all right. Now, did you have any... how did the tactical end of things at Rucker work?
Well, I was lucky. When I got in there, I got into the guns
mm-hmm.
section of it.
Okay.
So that's what everybody wanted to do, and I don't know how I got picked, but anyhow, I got into that, and that was a lot of fun, flying those UEs down the gun course and everything. So we didn't have to fly formations like the rest of the guys did.
Really?
And so that was very enjoyable.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And these were Bravo and Charlie model Hueys?
I think they were Charlie, but they could have been Bravos, too.
Okay.
But I think most of them were Charlie models.
Mm, excellent.
Yeah.
So, what was the gun training like as far as weapon systems actually getting out on the range? How'd that work?
Oh, that was great. I mean, it was very well presented.
Mm-hmm.
They showed you, what you should be doing, setting up the mission, how to shoot the rockets and so forth. And also, we did, gun runs in the L landing zones and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And then they had gun runs set up where they had tanks and targets out there on the gun course, and you flew down the target and shot at the tanks and so forth.
Mm-hmm. So basically, you were practicing air assault and LZ prep type tactics?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. All right, when was the first time you saw Cobra? And what did you think?
First time was probably our Fort Walters.
Okay.
We saw them flying in, and then you just see them parked up there.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, everybody was, that's what we wanted. Everybody wanted to do is fly those.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that was probably the first time I saw one,
right.
Fort Walters.
Terrific. Anything specific at Fort Rucker that stands out in your mind?
Flying the in the gun section of it, that was very nice. Everybody was envious of you because you got to go into that section of it. So that was the best part of the training.
Right.
That was the most fun, of course.
Excellent. All right. You get orders to... You finish up Fort Rucker. You get orders to Hunter Army Airfield.
No, I didn't go to Hunter.
Oh, no.
No.
I'm sorry.
No. Nope.
Okay.
No.
Nope.
I was one of the ones that didn't go.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
When did you transition to the Cobra then?
Over in Vietnam.
Really? Excellent.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
I haven't actually spoken to anybody who went through the in-country transition yet.
Right.
So, mm-hmm. Okay. So then I assume you got orders straight to Vietnam from Fort Rucker.
Right, exactly.
Okay.
And when I went over to Vietnam, mm-hmm. I got selected to go into the 1st CAV headquarters of the ARA.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now,
I was at the headquarters unit.
Okay. So headquarters, 2nd and 20th?
Right, exactly.
Excellent. What was the process from leaving Rucker, going overseas? How was the trip over? And then, of course, what was your first impression upon getting in country?
Well, I think I had a 30-day vacation there.
Mm-hmm.
So I went home back to Pittsburgh for 30 days. And at that time, I was not married. So my parents had no idea where I was going and everything until the very end of my 30 days when I told them.
Really?
That I was going to Vietnam.
Huh. How did they take that?
It wasn't too bad because I don't think they had really an idea what was going on over there. They just saw it on the news and everything. They knew it was dangerous.
Hmm.
They knew some people, you know, in the area were killed and so forth.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. They were concerned, of course.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Were you aware of this situation in Vietnam, what we were trying to do there, et cetera?
What do you mean, the situation?
Well, I guess what our involvement exactly was, what we were trying to do as far as pursuing the war, et cetera.
Well, at that age, there was a lot of questions,
mm-hmm.
I believe. I don't know what everybody else told you, but I thought, years later, after going through the training and everything, mm-hmm. See, you're in a, how should I say, you're in an environment where you're confined,
mm-hmm.
You're confined to an army base,
right?
And you're programmed. I think there's a subtle program in there,
mm-hmm.
that you think you're doing the right thing and so forth,
right?
And then you see on TV the people protesting against the war and so forth,
mm-hmm.
and you think those people are wrong,
right?
Okay, mm-hmm. So now you're all gung-ho, you're all programmed to do your job, which is excellent, because mm-hmm. that's probably what saved a lot of people's lives,
right.
Because you didn't think
mm-hmm.
Of the alternative. Is this the right thing to do? Is this the wrong thing to do? Should I do this? Should I do that? You just did it because you were programmed.
Right.
And then you had a lot of peer pressure from your fellow pilots and so forth to mm-hmm. do everything right.
Right.
And that was one of the things was great about being with the 2nd and the 20th, and especially Charlie Battery, because I thought we were the best of the best.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. All right.
Now you asked me, going to Vietnam, mm-hmm. what was my
first impression? Yeah.
I was scared twice when I was in Vietnam.
Really?
The first time was when I was coming in, mm-hmm. landing in Saigon.
Okay.
And I looked out the window, and it was just like the war movies.
Really?
And I said, what the hell am I doing over here?
Okay.
And I finally realized, you know, this is serious.
Mm-hmm.
This is something that's, you know, not good. And, you know, if you can just picture looking out your window of the airplane and seeing, you know, the sky lit up, you know, red and then white and so forth, and mm-hmm. it was a moment that I'll never forget. That's when it really hit me that this is serious business.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
When exactly did you arrive in country?
When did I arrive?
Yeah.
I think the day after they landed on the moon.
Okay.
In July of 69.
Right.
Right.
It's July 21st. Yeah. Wow. Okay.
I think I was over at the Pacific when the pilot came on and says they landed on the moon.
Really?
Yeah.
Excellent. What was that like? I mean, you're just hearing about that.
Well, flying over, you know, there was, it was on a 707.
Uh-huh.
I guess there was, I don't know, 150 guys on there or that. But there was 13 officers,
mm-hmm.
okay? And all of those were warrant officers, mainly out of my class.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so we were the ranking officers.
Okay.
And we were the only ones that had the booze.
Ah.
So we drank the whole time over there.
Gotcha.
And they were after us. No, the poor flight attendants were after us. You guys can't have this booze up here. And we said, well, who's the ranking officers? And they said, well, you guys are. I said, what are you going to do, send us to Vietnam? You know? So
yeah.
We drank the whole time going over.
Wow. Well, that certainly is stress relief. Definitely a stressful
Well, it's a
situation.
24-hour flight.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, okay. Getting into Vietnam, how did you get your unit assignment? How did that process work?
To this day, I have no idea how it worked. You just get in these lines,
okay.
And they tell you where you need to go.
Okay.
That's as far as I know. And I guess the only reason I got with the 2nd and the 20th is because I had the gun training in Fort Rucker.
Okay.
But I was not Cobra qualified at that time.
Hmm. Okay.
And I guess I was just fortunate that they had an opening at the battalion headquarters for a helicopter pilot.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So
yeah.
I guess it's just being in the right place at the right time.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Definitely. How did your transition training work then? Getting from HQ battery or headquarters battery at the 2nd and the 20th into Cobra transition, et cetera?
Well, I was very fortunate. I was in with an officer. His name is Major Cienciola.
Okay.
And I was in there with a bunch of lieutenants and captains, and I was just a W-1
mm-hmm.
at that time. But I was good. I was a good pilot, and he recognized that.
Mm-hmm.
And so he took me underneath his wing, if you want to call it that.
Okay.
And he gave me a lot of opportunity to do what I could do best, which was fly the helicopters. And, after a certain period of time, he made me aircraft commander before he made the lieutenants and captains.
Really?
Yeah.
Hmm.
And he and I got along great. He's an excellent, excellent person.
Hmm.
In fact, last time I saw him was probably in December of 69. Just a couple of years ago, I called him up because of his name is so unique,
mm-hmm.
Cienciola.
Mm-hmm.
And here he was, a 3-star general, retired.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah. So I have talked to him over the years and so forth.
Uh-huh.
And he was just one of those people, John, that you knew he was going to be something good in life,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Excellent.
So anyhow, that was down at the battalion. So I made aircraft commander, soon after I got there.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very enjoyable, very enjoyable.
Great.
Mm-hmm.
Now, at this time, had the 2nd and the 20th gone completely Cobras, or were there still Charlie model gunships around as well?
I think they were all Cobras, and we may have had one in the battalion.
Okay.
I think when I first got there, I think they were all C models that we had,
mm-hmm.
and then we got the newer models in
okay.
for the UEs.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Now, transitioning from the Huey to the Cobra, what were the similarities, differences, difficulties, et cetera?
Well, I went to in-country training for the Cobras down in Vong Tau.
Okay.
And That was pretty easy. I didn't have any problems whatsoever doing that.
Okay, that was a two-week program?
I don't think so. I think it was at least 4 weeks, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
Excellent.
I could be wrong, John.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, I wasn't sure. I was just going through the original First Aviation Brigade records just before. And initially, it said it was going to be a two-week course. I think they did extend it to four.
I don't think it was two weeks. I think it was longer than that.
Yeah, I think it was actually four. They did extend it.
And I just loved it. I just loved it.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, it's a wicked-looking helicopter. It really is. What was the biggest... I don't want to say advantage, the biggest advantage from the Cobra over the Huey guns that you were used to flying?
The power.
Okay.
And you can fly faster.
Mm-hmm.
It was a smaller object to shoot at. I think you could carry more weapons on a Cobra than you could carry on a Charlie model.
Mm-hmm.
So it is fast, smaller target, and you can use the what would you call it? Well, you can do a lot more things with a Cobra. It's a lot more controllable, I think, than in Huey.
Hmm, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what was it like flying it from the front seat?
Flying from the front seat?
Yeah.
Well, at first, your controls are much smaller, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Everything was more condensed. Your movements and everything was more sensitive.
Mm-hmm.
So you really had to watch. You did not overcorrect from the front seat because of the control movements.
Mm-hmm.
So that was totally different flying from the front seat.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because your cyclic was over there on the right.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I haven't actually gotten into the Cobra that I'm going to be working on yet, so I haven't felt the controls or anything.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously, considering it's not powered, you really don't get the actual feel of it. But, I mean, how much of a throw was on the cyclic and everything?
On the front seat?
Yeah.
That is very small.
Really?
It would be like driving a race car.
Okay.
Like a Formula One race car. Where you just you just move it.
All right.
You know.
I mean, even the smallest inputs.
Right.
Okay.
Exactly.
Excellent. All right.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Now, what was your first combat mission like?
Wow. it was flying from the front seat, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Probably just like anybody, you're probably along for the ride.
Okay.
Everything's going so fast, and I would imagine it was just trying to collect everything that was going on all the time.
Hmm. Yeah, that seems to be the fairly common first mission. What did you do yourself to, I guess, slow things down and get an idea of what was going on for your next missions? Was there anything in particular that you used to help with that?
Let me think, John. Besides drink a lot of beer, let's see. I would imagine... getting over the initial nervousness of the situation, having the aircraft commander give you more responsibility.
Okay.
talking to the other new pilots,
mm-hmm.
Listening to the aircraft commanders, and trying to put everything in a perspective where it made sense to you, what was the reason for everything.
Okay.
I would imagine doing that.
Hmm.
I think a lot had to do with the aircraft commander, how he treated you, and what you wanted to do. I mean, what I meant by that is, did you just want to sit there and do nothing, or did you want to get involved? And how much leash did he give you in regards to the mission? Now, when you first came into the unit, you know the initials FNG, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know what that stands
for?
Yes,
sir, I do.
Okay. So there was a lot of harassment that went along with that.
Okay.
Okay. And so it was up to yourself to get more involved and do the right thing. Okay. And I think getting with the program had to do a lot with the aircraft commander and how he treated you, and the personalities going back and forth.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Now, how did you? I guess, well, after transition training at Vung Tau, moving back to headquarters, Battery 2nd of the 20th, were you then assigned to Charlie Battery, or did you?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. And that was at Quan Loi at that point?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
What was it like moving out to one of the operational batteries?
Well, of course, being in the battalion, I flew to all of them all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to go to the Charlie Battery because I thought that was the best one of the whole group.
Mm-hmm.
And so the transition to me was very easy. Okay. I knew all the officers. I knew the pilots and so forth. And so it was a very easy transition for me.
Great. Great. Any particular reason why Charlie Battery?
I think the group of people up there, I don't know how many people you have talked to or whoever, but I just thought the group of guys at Charlie Battery were the best.
Mm-hmm.
We had a hell of a good time, and no. I just really blended in there with those people.
Great.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Let's see. Well. Okay. Going operational with Charlie Battery. Any memorable missions early on? Yeah, I guess well throughout your tour, but I mean, guess what was what really stands out to you mission wise?
Well, there was a couple of them. Of course, this Medevac Meadow was one of the ones that was also tragic, and also you know, when you saw Sergeant Rocco down there saving all those people's lives and so forth. That was very impressive what he did that day.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second mission that comes to my mind is flying at night in Cambodia.
Mm.
We were supporting a fire base out there. And what we did, you're familiar with how we make the gun runs and everything?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So what happened was... I think I went in first, after we talked to the commander on the ground, he told us where to shoot and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I went in and shot, and I pulled up, and my windship, you haven't talked to George Alexander yet, have you?
No, I haven't, actually. I have his email address, and I will be talking to him soon. But
I would highly recommend to talk to George.
Okay.
Crazy George.
All right.
George and I flew a lot together over there. And he's just a super person, and I think you would really enjoy talking to him, and I know he'll enjoy talking to you.
Great.
But anyhow, what happened is I went in first and shot, and you have to pull up and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And George came in and shot, And then I came around and shot again, and George came around. So on the third time, okay, and all this time we're not taking fire,
mm-hmm.
okay. On the third time around, I called the commander on the ground, and I says, are you sure we're shooting at the right place? Because, no, we're not taking fire. We don't see any activity or anything. And he says, yeah, you're hitting them right on. So I come in for the third time, shot, and as soon as I start pulling up, all hell broke loose.
Really?
I mean, they were just waiting for us.
Hmm.
You know, they let us make two rounds of it, and they got our position and everything. And it was a low ceiling that night. The clouds were low,
mm-hmm.
okay? So we were a little bit lower than what we should have been, but, you know, you had to get below the clouds.
Mm-hmm.
And so... all I saw in front of me was red.
Really?
Because of the tracers.
Wow.
The tracers were coming up and they were hitting the clouds. Okay? And the clouds were turning red.
Wow.
And this is all in front of me. Okay? And so I'm sitting there and I'm saying to myself, well, if I continue to go frontwards, I'm going to get shot.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Because they knew, based upon the prior two runs, what we were going to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I pulled up that Cobra, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So here I am. I'm nose up now, mm-hmm. okay? And I'm going as straight up as I can because I can't go forward.
Right.
And here I am now in the clouds, okay?
Mm.
And everything's red
okay.
because I'm completely in the clouds and the tracers are lighting everything up in red.
Uh-huh.
And I stalled the Cobra.
Whoa.
Okay?
Uh-huh.
And that's not good.
No.
Okay, so the only way I could get out of it, I kicked it to the right,
uh-huh.
and I had enough altitude where I could get my airspeed back up. And now, if you can picture this, you know, going straight up, everything's red in front of you. You turn, and you're still in the clouds, and you're almost sideways coming down
uh-huh.
at a high speed now. And, you know, you hope you have enough altitude so you can pull that sucker out.
Right.
At the bottom there.
Oh, man.
And so that's what happened.
Huh.
And George, my windship, as soon as he saw what was going on, he radioed and said, I'm turning off my lights. Mm-hmm. Okay. So I didn't know where he was because he turned his lights off.
Uh-huh.
So they couldn't see him from the ground.
Oh, boy.
And there I am fighting this thing because I stalled it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was a lot of fun.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was the second time I got scared in Vietnam.
Huh. I can imagine. How did you, do you know what the process was you went through to recover it?
I would imagine what happened is when I got up there and I noticed I had to do something because the thing was probably starting to shake.
Mm-hmm.
The only way out was to kick in the right rudder
mm-hmm.
and get the thing over so I can get airspeed.
Right. Okay.
Okay. And then the second thing was hopefully I had enough altitude
right.
where I can pull back out at the very end.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All
right. Yeah.
Wow. Hmm. Now, I guess... moving on to Medevac Meadow,
okay.
Can you, go into detail as to what the mission started off as, what it became, and your experience there?
Well, the Medevac missions overall were dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, what we did is one Cobra flew low
mm-hmm.
around the Medevac and one flew higher, okay?
Right.
On this particular mission, George was the low ship.
Right.
Okay. And after all these years with some talking and so forth, when we got the mission, I believe it was supposed to be on a secure LZ.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Of course, they had wounded and everything, but what I remember. Was it was a secure LZ, so there was no problem.
Okay.
So George went down low with the medevac bird, and I was up higher.
Mm-hmm.
When he was coming in, he started taking fire. At that time, George and Moran, mm-hmm. Moran was in his front seat, I believe.
Yeah.
They went and start shooting at the at where the fire was coming from the tree line.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and I was up above, and I was trying to get George out of the way so I can shoot my rockets.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we took turns. George, when he vacated the area, I would come in and shoot rockets, and George would come in and shoot the miniguns and 40 millimeter.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he shot some rockets from low level. Okay. And then we saw what was going on down there. And I believe what happened is I came down onto the deck also
mm-hmm.
with George. And then we tried to protect Sergeant Rocco as he was going back and forth from the helicopter to the tree line.
Okay.
And I remember looking down and watching Sergeant Rocco. You can see the dirt around his feet kicking up from the bullets hitting around him.
Really?
Yeah. And what George and I did was we continued to suppress the fire as much as we could so he could go back and forth, back and forth from the woods to the helicopter.
Okay.
And did everything we could to protect him and also, bring in the rest of the medevacs and the cobras that were bounced to protect us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, what type of fire was this? Was it just small arms?
I think it was small arms, and I believe it's mainly small arms.
Okay. So no 51 cal?
I don't believe so.
Okay. Hmm. All right. Let's see. Now, how long, I guess, did you stay with them before you had to head back and refuel and rearm?
Well, as you know, we have a limited amount of fuel that we can maintain.
Mm.
So we shot everything we had, I believe. I know George and I, we shot all our rockets, all the miniguns and 40 millimeter that we had.
Mm-hmm.
I believe we were probably on station maybe an hour, maybe. Mm-hmm. I don't know. and at that time, the second medevac was on station.
Mm-hmm.
You know his name?
Hank Tool?
Right.
Right, yes.
And I think that we covered him going in also. And then he took fire, and he had he did not land. He had to take off again.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let's see. I guess the next wave comes in and I guess relieves you on station. Did you go back, rearm, and then come back out?
I don't know. I don't remember that.
Okay.
I don't know, John.
Okay. Now, Jim had mentioned the following morning mounting basically the entire battery going out on the rescue mission.
Mm-hmm.
Were you a part of that, and what was your experience there?
I don't remember that day. I don't remember.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Very cool. Certainly, it's amazing hearing the different perspectives of the mission, just how it all fits together. It's very as a historian, it's rather rewarding.
Well, do you know that George and I put Sergeant Rocco in for the Medal of Honor?
Really? No, actually, I didn't.
Okay, there's a whole story that has evolved from there now.
Okay.
After that mission and everything, we all talked about it and everything, and George and I went over to the headquarters over there, and we wrote up the recommendation for Sergeant Rocco to get the Medal of Honor.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's really the last time I was involved in that.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, a couple months later, Hank Toll wrote up a recommendation for George and I for the Silver Star
mm-hmm.
for that mission.
Really?
Okay. Were you aware of that?
No, I wasn't.
Okay. And I have the original documentation, a copy of it,
mm-hmm.
Signed in ink by Hank.
Mm.
Okay, and I kept it all these years. So, just in the last couple of months, we all start talking to each other again after 30-some years.
Uh-huh.
All right.
Really.
And I got a hold of Jim Moran, and of course, we all start telling war stories again.
Mm-hmm.
And Jim told me that Sergeant Rocco got the Medal of Honor, and that's the first time I heard about it.
Really?
It was a couple months ago.
Huh.
I think in March.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, that was right around when I started the project, and I started talking.
So I got all excited because I put him in for the Medal of Honor.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So I called Sergeant Rocco. He lives in San Antonio down here.
Okay.
And I was talking to him, and I said I was one of the pilots that put you in for the Medal of Honor. And he says, well, that's not what I heard.
Really?
And I says, well, I did. And he says, well, the medevac pilots put me in for the Medal of Honor. Okay. And he says, if you don't mind, I'm not feeling too good, because he has cancer.
Yes, I heard.
And he says, why don't you call Lee Carbono,
mm-hmm.
one of the medevac pilots, and talk to him, because he knows everything.
Okay.
So I called Lee. He lives over in Louisiana.
Uh-huh.
And I told Lee who I was and everything. And Lee says, yeah, he heard that some of the Cobra pilots put him in for the Medal of Honor, but the paperwork was lost.
Really?
Okay.
Huh.
And so he and the other captain that was there in the medevac put in for the Medal of Honor years later.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's how he got it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Hmm.
So I was talking to Lee and Hank Toll, and I said, George and I were put in for the Silver Star, and we never heard anything.
Mm-hmm.
And Lee says, well, during that time period, the first CAV lost a lot of the award recommendations.
Really?
And so I said to George Alexander, I says, well, George, if they lost our recommendation for Rocco for the Medal of Honor, I would imagine they lost our recommendation for the Silver Star.
Mm.
So what I've been doing in the last couple of months, and George has too, is trying to get all the information to resubmit our Silver Star.
Hmm. Okay.
And just yesterday, I got from the National Archives and Records Administration
mm-hmm.
some information about that medevac mission and everything.
Oh, excellent.
Have you talked to them?
Actually, I'm going to be heading there in about 3 weeks. I'm actually leaving. I'm from New York, and I'm leaving on Wednesday. This semester ends, and I'll be back up there for a couple months.
And well, you know where it's at?
Yeah, I do.
Okay. Would you like me to give you this person's name who did this?
Sure. Sure.
She's very familiar with it.
Is it Janine Swift?
No.
No? Okay.
Her name is Susan.
Okay.
Middle initial A.
Uh-huh.
And then she has a name, Francis
uh-huh.
Dash, and I'll spell the last name for you, H-A-U-G-H-T-O-N, Francis Hooten.
Okay.
And she's the one that did all this, and she was very helpful.
Excellent.
And she has this all documented that day, what happened.
Okay.
And it's mainly written up for Sergeant Rocco, though.
Wonderful.
And, if you want me to, I can mail this all to you.
That would be great. Yeah, that'd be fantastic.
And then you can see what's going on with
sure.
it. What was I going to tell you there? You want her phone number?
Yeah, actually, hold on. Let me just pause the recording.
What I'm doing now is I'm going to prepare a resubmission
mm-hmm.
of the Silver Star, and I'm going to get all the documentation that I have
mm-hmm.
and give it to a congressman. And if this congressman approves, then he'll send it on to the Army to have it reviewed again.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful.
So I don't know how much information that you can provide me to help me,
well,
if any.
Let's see. Well, as far as I've got right now, I've got at least one of the tail numbers of the aircraft involved, the major participants, basic altitudes and directions of gun runs, etc. But I've got all of that in the interviews with Jim Moran. So that's actually he sent me an article too, which I believe was in the Army Times.
That's the one George had from 1965?
Yeah.
Yeah, I have that. Oh, by the way, I have Susan's phone number if you want it now.
Okay, sure.
You ready? And what's your address, and I'll send this. And I'll send this to you, all this information she gave me.
Great.
So if you go down to see her, she'll recognize it and everything.
Yeah, we actually had the Triennial Vietnam Symposium here a few weeks ago, and two of the archivists came out and did a whole presentation. And one of the artifacts they used was a Xerox copy of the bar rules for the Blue Max Bar. And the whole Constitution and everything. It was amazing.
How did you get that?
They actually had made a copy of it from the National Archives, and they brought it out as part of their presentation. And you know, I was just sitting there. You know, I happened to be working that room on the AV equipment, and you know, we got to talking about it, and they gave it to me. And it's you know, it's a full size copy of it, and it was a scream. And it was actually from late 71, so it was after they had become F Battery 79th ARA.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, all the pilots had signed it at the bottom and everything, and of course, you know, just reading it was quite amusing.
Who has the original?
I assume the National Archives do.
Up there in Maryland?
Yeah.
How about that?
Yeah.
Huh. Well, I have a. Do you have a picture of it and everything?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. It's good stuff. It's funny, Jim sent me a picture of that he had taken of it, and I compared that to the Xerox that I have, and there are some differences, but the wording is pretty much the same.
Well, I have it on file. I can send it to you, for what it's worth.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay.
Did
anybody ever give you the ARA song?
Well, actually, you know, that was my next question. you know, Jim said he definitely needed a few beers before relating that to anyone.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Yeah, I haven't yet found that.
Yeah.
So.
You know, we had a lot of fun over there.
well, you know, I guess it's sort of, you know, a good way for stress relief, et cetera.
Yeah.
You know, and certainly being a stressful situation.
Yeah.
Well, let's see. We've been going for just a little under an hour now. Let's talk about the weapons loads and stuff. Was there any standard outfitting of a Cobra? How did loading up for a mission go?
Based upon, George knew a lot about that. When you talk to George, he'll describe that better than I can. You know, the rockets were, 10 pounds and 17 pounds, I
mm-hmm.
believe?
Yeah.
And so you had to get a mixture of that because of the weight.
Okay.
And then you put so many rounds of minigun and 40 millimeter in the front.
Mm-hmm.
Then you also had the Fouchette rockets.
Mm-hmm.
You're familiar with those?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. And so there's all a mixture there between what you wanted to do and how much weight you can carry.
Okay.
And I don't know the exact ratio
okay.
at this time. I really don't.
All right. Now, how did you, go about selecting what rockets you were going to use? For example, you're in a situation you need flechettes. How do you select those?
Well, you usually, when the helicopters are sitting there for a mission, I would say 100% of the time they're set up for the 10-pound, 17-pound rockets.
Okay.
Okay. Only when you had a special occasion would those rockets be pulled out and the flechettes put back in.
Okay.
So you really had a special mission to go on before you put the flechettes in there.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense. Now, were there any... I've got pictures of tail number 600, which had twin miniguns. Were there any other different armament configurations that you were aware of, that you remember?
No. No, I'm sorry, I don't.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Any 20-millimeter birds arrive when you were there?
I think they came in, but we didn't have any.
Okay.
But I can remember the pilots talking about those that flew them, because at first there was a lot of vibration and everything because they weren't the structure was not supported to handle that pounding.
Right.
So there was a problem with the structure at first.
Okay.
Yeah. But I never shot one.
Hmm. No. Okay. All right. Now, your assigned aircraft, do you remember the tail number and whether any, was there any nose art or anything like that on it?
I don't remember any of the tail numbers.
Okay.
No.
All right.
No.
Okay. So I know later on, Jim was telling me there were, he said there were a couple with distinctive nose art, Murder, Inc., Sound of Silence, etc.
Mm-hmm.
But there was none. There were no aircraft marked.
That's why it'd be interesting for you to talk to George, because George would have a lot more details on the aircraft.
Okay.
And because, like the warrant officers, we're only there really to fly.
Right.
Where the captains and lieutenants had support functions to do.
Right.
So George got involved with the mechanics and everything more.
Okay.
Because he was a captain.
Okay. Excellent.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, where exactly, I know Medevac Meadow was during the Cambodian incursion. Was that actually in Cambodia, or was it in Vietnam?
Okay. No, it was in Cambodia.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And you knew we flew into Cambodia before it was legal, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Of
course. You know the sequence of how that occurred?
No, no.
What would happen is the mission would come down. Okay, and when you took off, of course, the mission was given to the co-pilot, the guy in the front seat, so you didn't know where you were going.
Mm-hmm.
You knew that, right,
no.
On our missions?
No, actually, I wasn't aware of that.
Okay. We were on, like, a two-minute call, okay? And there was a horn that blew,
right,
and you had 2 minutes to get into the helicopter and take off,
okay.
24 hours a day, okay? And so when you got the mission... you didn't know where you were going until the co-pilot would write it on the inside of the window.
Mm-hmm.
And after a while, you would recognize the grids and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So you knew essentially where you were going. Then you had to call somebody to find out what was going on, actually.
Okay.
And on the ones for Cambodia before May of 1970, you would have a mission inside of Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and then when you got there, you were told to call a certain frequency, and at that time, it would be somebody, I believe, up in a C-130
mm-hmm.
Air Force,
yeah,
and then they would give you a mission into Cambodia from there.
Okay.
Okay.
And what did you think about doing that?
Well, after a while, you knew once the grid comes up, you knew what was going on, and you would just say, oh, shit. Because you know what was going to happen.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And then you flew in there. And, of course, anything happened to you over there before May of 70, it was your fault. I mean, no, you were off course or something happened, you know.
All right. Now, was there any difference in contact once you were in Cambodia as opposed to operations in Vietnam?
Well, before May of 70, they were special forces missions.
Okay.
So you were working with a small group of people, like maybe three or five on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the time they would be whispering to you because the enemy was right there with them.
Okay.
So it was a very small group of individuals you were working with and a special mission. Yeah.
Okay. As far as, you know, ground fire and stuff like that, was it more intense?
No, because they weren't inspecting you.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Hmm. Were there any particular incidents you were involved in pre-May of 70 in Cambodia?
Yeah, one sad mission. We were supporting a special forces on the ground, and... he was in immediate danger. I mean, they were right there with him, and he started to break down, you know. So that was very emotional.
Really?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, let's see. I guess is there anything else about your tour that really stands out?
Well, being up in Charlie Battery, I thought that we had a swagger, if you want to call it that. Mm-hmm. I thought we were the best of the best. I think we acted that way. When we did our job, I thought we did our job very professionally. Mm-hmm. We had a lot of fun. There's a good group of guys. You know, after 30 years, we're starting to talk to each other again.
Mm-hmm.
And it's nice to talk to some of the guys again. And there were some good times, and I enjoyed it as much as you can enjoy combat.
Mm. Excellent. Mm-hmm. All right. Now, I guess heading home, you finished your tour. You're pretty much done with. What was the experience getting out of country, getting back to the States, and getting home?
Let's see, I got a couple more minutes here. Going home, you know, you were, in your last month, it started to change for you. You become a little bit more conservative and so forth. You start thinking about leaving and so forth. And, so coming back, it's kind of a letdown, because, you know, just imagine, you know, your life being on the line 24 hours a day, and now that's gone. I mean,
right.
So you're relaxed and so forth. And so it was just getting down from a high, if you want to call it that, you know, withdrawal.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. How was transitioning? And was going through that for you?
I had no problem. It's just getting your body to settle down. I noticed things. Well, like my sister said when I came back, she says I could hardly look at you because of the look in your eyes.
Really?
Yeah.
Hmm.
No, nothing fazed you after that. Hmm. I mean, you weren't scared of anything.
Really?
I mean, no. Just nothing fazed you, yeah, for a long time.
Hmm. Wow. Right. Well, I guess that's pretty much all I've got for now. I don't know. Let me just stop the recording, end this officially. This will end the interview with Mr. Paul Garrity on May 3rd.